the week of January 19th, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 221, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Park City, Utah, covering the Sundance Film Festival, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
Yeah, and I'm Michael Giltz in New York, boring old New York.
Well, New York has its values as well.
Yeah. And of course, you're at the Sundance Film Festival. We'll be talking about that. But what else will we cover on today's show?
Well, on today's show, we'll be talking about the Oscar nominations, which happened last week, and how it looks for the movies competing in one of the closest races in memory for Best Picture. The Guild Awards certainly didn't clear things up. SAG gave their top prize to American Hustle, but the Producers Guild had the first tie in its entire history, and neither of the winners was American Hustle. I'll be taunting Michael a little bit with a live report from Sundance, telling him about all the fun I'm having and the great movies I've seen and all of the people I'm meeting.
The free stuff you're getting.
Yeah, well, actually, I'm not getting anything. I'm not even eating, practically. But, of course, there's a lot of industry up here, a lot of executives and acquisitions executives. It's very insidery here in Park City this week. So on Inside Baseball, we'll discuss the court ruling that may have put the kibosh on net neutrality, something that will affect virtually everyone. And did you see how I worked in the word virtually? Did you? Did you see
that? Yeah.
Because virtually okay. Now, of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire out of New York City, Michael Giltz, to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. We're talking about worldwide box office here, not just North America. And the number one movie around the world is Ride Along, the Kevin Hart Ice Cube film. It opened to $41 million. Over the Martin Luther King weekend, it's had the biggest opening of that weekend in history. And it's a big success for Kevin Hart, who's finally broken out in a movie other than a stand-up comedy film. At number two around the world, a bit of a disappointment is Jack Ryan, Shadow Recruit. This is the would-be franchise starring Chris Pines of Star Trek. It opened just behind Ride Along. Ride Along made $41 million. Jack Ryan made $39 million. So it sounds like they're in a dead heat, except Ride Along only opened up in North America, whereas Jack Ryan opened up in 30 territories and still could not be Ride Along.
Right, and I think in the U.S., in North America, it earned $17.2 million, which I think Paramount Pictures can, you know, I think they'd be disappointed with that.
Absolutely. It opened in fourth place behind Ride Along, the fourth weekend of Lone Survivor, behind an animated film called The Nut Job, which we'll get to in a minute. So it's in fourth place in North America, but it only cost $60 million to make. It's doing pretty well overseas. We'll have to see where it ends up. It costs $60 million. If it makes $150 million, $180 million, they may be able to justify, you know, a second chance at this movie. Nonetheless, you know, you say, well, all right, Jack Ryan, it's got all the rest of the world to play in. Ride Along only gets to play in North America because they may not even open that up overseas. So, you know, if you're looking at the final totals for what these movies cost, Ride Along may not be that much better or might be well behind Jack Ryan once all is said and done. However, even though it's only going to play in North America and may not even open up overseas, it only costs $25 million to make. So it's almost doubled its budget after its first 4 days in the theaters. So that's just a big success story, no matter how you slice it.
Now, you have to remember that the Jack Ryan movie was moved from December of last year, 2013, into 2014, into January of 2014. And the big reasoning behind that was, well, we want to push Wolf of Wall Street as Paramount Pictures because we're going to release that. And we don't want to flood the market with too many movies. And there are too many movies in theaters at the end of the year right now. So we'll move it to January or February. And everybody kind of used that as the, you see, we're doing smart programming. As opposed to what normally happens when a movie gets pushed, it's just bad and they're trying to find a window to release it in where it won't have a lot of competition. Unfortunately, this movie did not get great reviews and, you know, it's kind of...
It got sort of polite reviews. People were like, well, it's nothing special, but it's efficient and it gets the job done and Chris Pine is an affable lead.
Right.
And I would say they certainly made the right move commercially.
Right.
Because my God, if they only made $17 million in mid-January, they probably would have disappeared completely come December time. So I think it was a smart move, no matter what you think of the movie's value as a film.
That's right. I would agree.
At number three around the world is Frozen, the Disney animated film. It's still chugging along. That's chugging along. That's not even the word. It's still steamrolling along. It's snowballing. It's such a big success. $36 million worldwide. It's at $760 million and counting. At number four, that film you mentioned that Jack Ryan made way for, The Wolf of Wall Street, another $34 million. It's just under $150 million worldwide. It cost $100 million to make, but it's done quite well in North America, not taking into account its budget. It's about to get close to $100 million, and it's making good money overseas. We'll have to see where it ends up. It's only in 20 territories, so it has a lot of room to grow down the road. I don't think it's even opened up in Japan, which is a big territory for Leonardo DiCaprio.
That's true. Now, we should also point out a couple things about Wolf of Wall Street. It was just nominated for a number of Academy Awards, including Best Director and Best Actor, but it was the first film to be distributed digitally only. So there were no 35 millimeter film prints that were sent out in North America. So in Latin America and Europe and Asia.
That's the first one of a wide release?
The first one of a wide release that wasn't a 3D conversion. So Jurassic Park 3D only had IMAX prints go out. But really, you're not going to show that movie on 35 millimeter film because then it wouldn't be in 3D. And what's the point of releasing Jurassic Park 3D if you're not going to see it in 3D? So
now I didn't know that. And they obviously did not make a big point of that because it wasn't something they felt the need to tout. It wasn't that they were ashamed of it, but they said, why bring it up? But it's kind of ironic given that Martin Scorsese is such a big person behind the drive to preserve film and, or in this case, a digital print of a film, but he's a big film preservationist and he's the first director to have a wide release go out that's not on film.
Right. And I don't necessarily know that he had that much say over whether it went out digitally or whether any 35 millimeter prints were made, because really, film labs are going out of business and film.
I'm not saying I doubt he pushed for it.
No,
but
he may have even said
cut up. I'm sure he said, strike me a print and strike a print for the Library of Congress or somebody. So I'm sure he did that.
Oh, yeah, but, absolutely. For archival purposes.
But that's just a funny little quirk that he, of all people, would be the one to have the first wide release with no film whatsoever, no celluloid for that movie. That's fascinating.
Yeah, well, it also marks an important moment because everybody's been wondering in the industry, gee, when will film be turned off? When will the studios turn film off? And 20th Century Fox and Disney have sent out letters way back in 2011 warning exhibitors, warning theater owners, hey, at some point we will have to stop film delivery. So you should really convert as soon as possible, convert to digital. And they didn't give a date. And no studio really wanted to be the first to turn film off for a couple of reasons. Nobody wanted to be seen abandoning
film. As the
film.
Bad guy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Nor did they want to. You know, there's some antitrust issues there and some legal issues about abandoning a platform or a format, I should say, that you have supported for, you know, 100 years because other businesses rely on you using that format, such as small town exhibitors, small town theater owners, many of whom are barely squeaking by, who can't afford the transition. And there's about 3,000 to 4,000 screens that have yet to convert. And at the Inter Society meeting last Wednesday,
out of how many?
Out of about 40,000.
Is that screens or theater locations?
Those are screens, so, not theater locations.
So there's about 20,000 screens, meaning if my multiplex has 20 screens, that's not one location, that's 20 screens. And so there's about 20,000 screens overall in the country.
No. There's probably about 44,000 screens in North America.
Oh, 44,000 screens and 10% of them, less than 10%, have not converted over to digital.
Right. And the question is, will some of those screens kind of fade away and go out of business?
Right.
Or will some of them try to make the conversion? They're having trouble converting. Most of these screens are independently owned. They are the only cinema servicing, you know, a community, usually rural, for hundreds of miles. And, you know, as was pointed out during the Inter Society meeting, you know, these people who live in these communities don't always live in those communities. And a lot of these companies, these studios, are also electronics manufacturers, and they want to maintain a culture of cinema going. So it's important for them, for the studios and for the theater owners, to remain open. If they can't afford digital equipment, it's going to be a big problem.
Well, I'm surprised that that's the first film. Obviously, a lot of films mostly went out digitally last year, even if they had some celluloid prints still struck. The vast majority of them were released mostly digitally, right?
Yes, mostly digitally, because at this point, I think there's 40,000 screens in the U.S. That have converted. Most of them in the major chains are 100% digital at this point. If they're not, those screens that aren't digital will probably be closing for good or sold to another theater owner. In the EU, it's the same thing.
And it's not surprising a movie like Wolf of Wall Street would be the first one because it's very much an urban film, a film that you would think would not play as well in small towns necessarily. It's a stereotype, of course. Any good movie should play well everywhere. But you know what it is. It probably is much stronger in cities and high-density population areas. So it's a film that, for that last 8% of screens, probably those aren't important screens to them.
Well, I think, you know, no studio would ever say that. I think they would.
That's why we're here.
Yeah, they would argue that every single screen that they can get their film on is revenue for them, which is true. And I think they honestly believe and think that. As one distributor once told me, if we could make $10 per week on a screen, we'll want to keep that screen.
Well, that's dumb.
Well, that's the distributor's point of view, remember.
Yeah, that's dumb. Like I said, again, we, you know, the number of people in that screen can affect. So if you can be on half the screens and have a happier audience, you're better off long term. But anyway, there we go. That's the first film. There'll be many, many more in 2014. That's not just a quirky little thing at the end of the year. That's the trend that's going to be start coming up. We're going to see all year long movies that are only released digitally, right? Because they're basically done with film.
Absolutely. It's getting harder to find film stock. It's getting harder to make release prints. And quite honestly, now that Paramount Pictures has, and this was kind of a leaked story to the LA Times. I think Paramount Pictures probably leaked it just to see what the reaction would be. But now that Paramount Pictures has done this.
And nobody cares.
I would not be shocked if other studios follow suit relatively quickly.
But we've been saying for a while that this was the last, 2013 was the last year for celluloid. I'm surprised it's only at the end of the year that we see a major film released this way.
Well, I think most of 2013 was the actual rollout. That's when a lot of cinemas were converting. So I think before Paramount could release Wolf of Wall Street in a digital-only format, I think they needed to wait for all of the cinemas to convert. And by the end of 2013, as you see, over 90% of North American cinemas have converted.
All right. Well, number five around the world is Lone Survivor, another $23 million. It's at $78 million worldwide. It's in four territories. And number six, one of the movies that beat out Jack Ryan's Shadow Recruit is an animated film called The Nut Job. It's a Canadian-South Korean co-production. It made $20 million. It opened in North America only. Not very good reviews, but it's the only family film option. Obviously, Frozen has had the feel to itself for a long, long time. So that's probably why the Nut Job opened pretty well.
Well, and I'm pretty sure that Open Road, which is owned, by the way, by cinema owners. It's owned by Cinemark, AMC, and Regal, if I'm not mistaken. I think it's the three of them own Open Road Pictures, which is releasing this film. I'm sure they felt that they would have the cinemas to themselves when it came to family fare, and that Frozen would not have played as well as it has all the way into January.
Well, they programmed themselves fine. I mean,
yes,
Frozen is at number five, which is pretty impressive. It's still in double digits, meaning $11 million. It's above the single million-dollar mark. So it's made $11 million, almost $12 million in its ninth weekend of release. That's pretty darn great. But certainly it's plenty of room and time, and they didn't make a mistake there. At number seven, another animated film, it's Boonie Bears. It opened to $15 million. I believe it opened in China. This is a spinoff of a TV series about two bears who try to stop a logger from cutting down their forest. They've had like hundreds of episodes. It's become more and more popular over the years. The bears are called Briar and Bramble. And there's also a little scaredy cat squirrel who's along for the fun. But it's a big show in China. We're going to see another movie just like that in a minute. But it's an animated film. This is a feature movie spinoff, the first one. And it's opened quite strongly with $15 million.
Does the squirrel look more like a rat? And is it constantly trying to find an acorn?
I'm sure they had that in mind. At number eight is The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug, another $14 million. At number nine, one of the big winners in the Oscar nomination race, American Hustle. That made $11.8 million. It's at $117 million worldwide. It got the biggest percentage bump from all the movies that are out there right now that got Oscar nominations. Gravity is still in the top 15, top 20. 12 Years a Slave is at number 17. And then, of course, there's American Hustle, which is all the way up at number six. It made another $10 million in North America alone. So it had the biggest success story. So now we know there's a long history of movies opening in February, May, July. You don't have to open in December to win Oscars. But when you're talking about benefiting at the box office, obviously, if you're a movie that's out and peaking just when Oscar nominations are coming out, you're going to do the best because that's what you've positioned yourself for. American Hustle is perfectly poised to do that. 12 Years a Slave has been out for a long time. It's going to be out in a few more theaters, but it did not benefit as much because it's already played out. Everyone's seen it who wants to see it. The same is true for Gravity. So if you're trying to benefit at the box office, American Hustle has done it right. If you want to win the Oscar, you don't have to open up at the end of the year. So we'll have to see what happens. All right, at number 10 is Devil's Due. This is a horror film, opened up in 7 territories, but made most of its money in North America, made $10.5 million. It's at a total of $11 million, so it must have opened up somewhere else a week earlier. Very bad reviews for this very bad horror film, and still it managed to make $11 million. At number 11, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, another $9 million. At number 12, Despicable Me 2, another $9 million. It's at $954 million worldwide. I was just with the mother yesterday who bought a Carl doll at Barnes & Noble. That's the one-eyed little guy. What are they called?
I have no idea.
The Minions. Yeah, Carl, the one-eyed Minion. She bought that doll just yesterday. At number 13 is August, Osage County, another $8 million. That's at $25 million and counting. Number 14, 12 Years a Slave. It's playing overseas now. It's in 12 territories. It made $8 million, and it's at $61 million and counting. A terrific success story for a movie that didn't cost a lot to make. At number 15, Paranormal Activity, The Marked Ones. That's at $75 million worldwide. And then 47, Ronin, is right below it. It's at $116 million worldwide, but it's clearly not even close to a success story, and it's getting slowly played out. And at number 17, the other animated film I was talking about, it's Pleasant Goat and the Big Bad Wolf. This is the fifth film in a series. It's the fifth feature film spinoff from a Chinese animated TV series. They release a movie every year, apparently tied into the animal of the zodiac for that year. So I guess a horse will play a big role in this movie, because we've had in previous years, the whatever the year of the whatever it is, that character has played a big part in the movie. So this year it's Pleasant Goat and the Big Bad Wolf 5. And apparently, I guess a horse will be a big player in that. It opened to $5 million. It's made $7 million so far. So clearly, Boonie Bears is the bigger winner.
Well, and then 18 is one of my favorite films from 2013, Her. It doesn't seem to be doing very well, at least. Well, I guess it made, only $750,000, or was that overseas?
It made $4 million in North America.
Okay.
So it dropped this week, despite getting some good, some very significant Oscar nominations, despite getting Best Director and Picture and a few other tech things. It did not get a Best Actor nomination for Joaquin Phoenix. So it has dropped in the box office from last weekend, but it made $4 million. Was not an expensive movie to make, but certainly it is not getting any momentum whatsoever, even though we both would say it's definitely one of the best movies of the year.
Absolutely. I would not be surprised to see Spike Jones, the director of the film and screenwriter, I would not be surprised to see him win the screenwriting award.
Well, it's hardly a given.
Well, true. I mean, look, I thought for sure that Joaquin Phoenix was a given for Best Actor for this film, because he's literally acting with nobody.
Yes, he's. Well, he gets to react with a voice, but that would mean you'd have to eliminate Christian Bale, who won an Oscar nomination for Best Actor in American Hustle, or Bruce Dern for Nebraska,
okay.
Leonardo DiCaprio for The Wolf of Wall Street, Chiwetel Ejiofor for 12 Years a Slave, and if you say he shouldn't get a nomination, then you're a racist, or Matthew McConaughey for Dallas Buyers Club, in which case you don't care about people with AIDS. So who are you going to take off that list?
Easy decision, Leonardo DiCaprio.
Fair enough. I might take out 3 or 4 of them, since I didn't care for most of those movies or performances. But yes, those are the people who've been nominated for Best Actor. The Oscar nominations were announced. It's a horse race in a lot of categories. I mean, Matthew McConaughey's gotten a lot of momentum lately, but given the love that was shown for Nebraska, I think Bruce Dern still has to be a major threat for Best Actor. Anyway, there were 9 films nominated for Best Picture. Of course, every year can fluctuate from 5 to 10 films, depending on how popular they are. So the better the horse race, the more movies that are competing for Best Picture, the more likely it is that you're going to have more films nominated. You know, if 2 movies are the movies that almost everybody votes for, you're going to only have 5 or 6 films. When there's a lot of different movies with a lot of different support for it, that's when you end up with 9 or 10 films. So this year we had 9 films nominated for Best Picture. That means the race is wide open. And the films are American Hustle, Captain Phillips, Dallas Buyers Club, which is the indie darling for this year, I would say.
Right.
Gravity, Her, the Joaquin Phoenix film, Nebraska, Philomena, which is also another indie darling that got a lot of love, and The Wolf of Wall Street.
You missed one movie, and that is 12 Years a Slave.
Oh, how did I miss that? I didn't scroll up high enough.
That's right, on our show notes there. Now, what I will say is the big snub here that everybody's talking about is Inside Llewyn Davis, the Coen Brothers film, was not nominated for Best Picture.
It was nominated for almost nothing, so it's not really a snub. They didn't like it.
Right.
Right, right. I mean, a snub, you know, again, there's no such snub. You know, you didn't get an Oscar nomination. It's not a snub. It's not like you deserved it or you know, you'd earned the right. So I think it's silly to talk about snubs, but that was certainly one movie that had not a lot of momentum. It was not up for a lot of these other awards. It wasn't up for a number of different categories and a number of different guilds or the Golden Globes, but it had no momentum. So there was no reason to expect it to get a lot of awards come Oscar time. It could have, as could have, of course, Lee Daniels' The Butler, which seemed like classic Oscar bait, but that too was basically ignored.
Correct. I would agree with everything you just said in regards to why Llewyn Davis and The Butler were kind of, well, as you say, ignored.
Right. So there's a lot of fun details to break apart in the Oscar nominations. For me, the big shocker was Nebraska getting a nomination for Best Supporting Actress. That was an award that nobody saw coming. And I think that shows that this movie has a lot of support for it. Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Supporting Actress. And I think there's a screenplay or something in there. Yes, Best Original Screenplay. And there's one, that might be it, or there might be one other award, but that's really a lot of love for that movie. So I think that's why Bruce Dern is still a major threat to Matthew McConaughey.
Well, I would agree with that, and I think mainly because I don't think Bruce Dern has won the Academy Award before, and he is not a young man.
Neither has Matthew McConaughey.
Well, yes, Bruce Dern is not a young man. He has been acting for his entire career, and it's very rare for roles such as the one that Bruce Dern is nominated for to actually show up and be as meaty and juicy as they are. So I think for him, I would not be upset to see him win Best Actor.
Well, I don't like the movie, so it wouldn't be my personal pick of the best performance of the year, but it's a perfectly fine performance. As far as whether he'll win, that's just what we're talking about. Matthew McConaughey has a great story as well. He came up in Dazed and Confused. That was his first breakout role. He was hilarious. He made a lot of good movies. Then he got lost in sort of romantic comedy banality for a number of years. He was making one crappy movie after another that, you know, made decent box office and kept him out there. But then he suddenly has reinvented himself, and he's made the last 5 or 10 movies have been interesting, have been smart. They've been indie. There've been some big movies. He's really pushed himself as an actual actor and gained a lot of credibility. So that sort of reinvention of yourself, I think, is very appealing to a lot of actors in Hollywood, a lot of people in Hollywood in general. As far as I know, he's a well-liked guy. So he has a great story to tell as well. And of course, it's a big dramatic role where you lose a lot of weight. And this sounds very flippant, but that's just how it goes. When you really transform your body physically and gain a lot of attention for that, that can really impact people. Just like Raging Bull for Robert De Niro, Matthew McConaughey's really outdone himself in this movie. So that's a good success story. The one thing against him is that Jared Leto looks like the strongest guy to win Best Supporting Actor for his flashy performance in Dallas Buyers Club. And they may feel like the movie's gotten enough love. Not that they really think about it this way, but the sentimentality of Bruce Dern may sway them, and they might say, oh, well, we already gave Dallas Buyers Club a big award, so we'll move on. So you never know what'll happen. Now, one of the biggest quirks, I think, is that American Hustle got nominations in all 4 acting categories: Best Actor, Best Actress, Best Supporting Actor, and Best Supporting Actress. It's only happened 15 times in the entire history of the Oscars, but it happened last year for David O. Russell's last movie, or the 2 years ago, the last time he did it, with Silver Linings Playbook.
And that was last year.
It was last year, okay.
And it got nominated for Best Director as well.
That's right. Does that mean it's a lock to win Best Picture?
No, not at all.
Why not?
Because lately, the love has been split. And based on the way there's 9 films and votes get split, it very easily could go... you know, there could be a vote split, effectively, is what I'm saying.
Well, there can always be a vote split, but does that mean, because it got all this, you know, every single acting category and picture and director, does that mean it's the most loved movie and could win Best Picture? I'm not asking if it'll be split between picture and director. I'm saying, will it win Best Picture because it got all those acting nominations?
Well, I think that at this point, right now in the award season, it really is coming down to American Hustle and 12 Years a Slave. That's at this point.
Not Gravity?
And I was going to say, Gravity, for some reason, I think peaked way too soon and has somehow fallen off of everybody's charts. It didn't even get nominated for screenplay. So I think, which I thought was a lock, at least a nomination.
I thought that was the weakest part of the movie. Gravity got mostly all technical nominations, of course, because it's a technical achievement.
Yes, and Alfonso Cuarón is nominated for Best Director.
And that seems to be where people are recognizing the movie the most. They just say, well, let's give Gravity Best Director.
Right.
Like, you may think 12 Years a Slave or American Hustle win Best Picture, but Alfonso Cuarón may be the guy to go in there and just steal Best Director away from one of them.
Right. And again, you could come down to a very tight race between Steve McQueen, Alfonso Cuarón, and David O. Russell. And, you know, it could just, you know, somebody could win by a hair.
Oh, absolutely. It'll definitely be a hair. And of course, the other reason why winning all those four nominations does not mean you're a lock to win Best Picture is because 15 films have done that, got nominations in all four acting categories, and only two have actually won Best Film.
Oh, you're doing sports statistics on me here.
That's right. That's Mrs. Miniver back in 1942, and From Here to Eternity back in 1953. So only the last time it happened was 61 years ago, that a movie won those four nominations in those four categories and then went on to win Best Picture. And the real reason why that is because it's just a quirk. Like, look at Gravity. There were only two actors in that movie, basically.
Right.
It couldn't win nominations in all four categories. So you have to be a good movie, a movie that people like, a movie that's going to get Oscar nominations. And you have to have four key roles, one in each category at least, so that you can actually get the nominations. So another movie that's loved even more may just have a female lead and no male lead. And that doesn't mean they like the movie less. It just means there was nobody eligible for that category that was really going to have a shot. So that's why that little quirk of winning all four acting categories and getting a nomination isn't quite so meaningful. It's certainly not a bad sign. Obviously, they like the movie if they give it all those acting nominations, but it really is just sort of a feature of what kind of film it is and the roles that you have that you can even do that. So it does not mean you're a lock for Best Picture.
You know, I think, speaking of acting nominations, I think any year in which Meryl Streep stars in a film, I think they should have six nominations for Best Actress. Because, once again, she was nominated for Best Actress for August, Osage County.
A movie that nobody likes.
And
the Oscar people saw it, and they don't like it. I mean, it's doing meh at the box office, but basically everybody's like, yeah, whatever. And so Meryl Streep got a nomination for a film that nobody really likes. That's really a shame. Emma Thompson is the one that people feel was cheated, if you want to talk about snubs.
Okay.
You know, people thought she might get one for Saving Mr. Banks, but it doesn't matter. She's not going to win. Emma Thompson wouldn't have won. It's either Cate Blanchett for Blue Jasmine or perhaps Amy Adams for American Hustle, though other people seem to think Judi Dench is the dark horse here.
Right, for Philomena.
Yeah, I thought they did a good job of pushing Sandra Bullock and making a point of how difficult and challenging her role was technically. Oh, she's a ballet dancer. She has all the challenges. I thought they really did a good part of getting across how difficult it is to do what she did, to give a performance basically against a blue screen and using mostly just your face. And yet she carried that film very well. And so I think they got her a nomination with a lot of artful marketing as far as that movie and how they sold it to the public and how they sold it to the Academy voters.
Yes, no, I agree.
Yeah. So there you go. There are other nominations. I think you can break them all down. Best animated film, Frozen is such a big hit. Does that hurt it? And does that mean The Wind Rises, the final film by Miyazaki, or could Ernest and Celestine slip in there? That's a film by people who won before, the people behind Triplets of Belleville. So there's no telling who will win that award, but we know that the best animated film will not be from Pixar because they were not nominated for Monsters University, and they almost always are. But The Croods and Despicable Me 2, which were both big hits, beat out Monsters University.
Well, and I think justifiably so.
Well, I think it should have been a list of three films if those are the best five they could come up with. I don't think The Croods should be nominated for anything.
Yeah, well, DreamWorks Animation did a good job of promoting that film.
That's right. And best foreign language film, it looks like the one to beat there is The Great Beauty, the Italian film. It's about sort of the glory days of Italian cinema in a way. And so it's sort of an ode to movie making, and it has an older actor.
Well, it's not really an ode to movie making. It doesn't star, you know, the main character is an author, but the author is kind of trying to, you know, like looking back on his life and is trying to figure out his next move and what it all means. So it's very much reminiscent of Fellini and 8½, and it's an ode to Fellini and 8½, and thus those types of movies. And so, yes, in a way, it's an ode to cinema, but a specific type of cinema.
It's not about making movies or anything like
correct,
that.
Correct, yes.
And of course, thank God, Jackass Presents Bad Grandpa was recognized. That got a best makeup nomination. And if you want to talk about rote nominations, forget Meryl Streep. Look at John Williams, who got his 874th nomination. That was for the score to The Book Thief, a movie nobody liked.
Or saw. I think that we should point to Best Original Song. And let me take this category for a minute.
All right.
Happy from Despicable Me 2, written by Pharrell Williams. everybody kind of thought, well, that's probably going to be up there. Let It Go from Frozen, and that was music.
It's a lock.
Yeah, it's a lock. Well, you think it's a lock to win or a lock to be nominated?
Oh, I think it'll win, but it was a lock to be nominated. Yeah.
Okay. The Moon Song from Her, which was written by Karen O and Spike Jones. So Karen O from the Yeah Yeah Yeahs. And Ordinary Love, from Mandela Long Walk to Freedom, which was written by U2.
And Alone Yet Not Alone from the movie of the same name, with music by Bruce Broughton and lyrics by Dennis Spiegel.
Now, wait a second. Michael, what is Alone Yet Not Alone? Now, you're probably wondering yourself what that movie is.
I am. I have no idea.
Okay. Now, that movie was one of those kind of small Christian-based films that was released, in very limited release into specific markets and did well in those markets because of the way it was released.
It did great in Knoxville, Tennessee, and Raleigh, North Carolina, and Colorado Springs, Colorado, and Grand Rapids, Michigan, and San Antonio, Texas.
Yes,
it was the number two film in Dallas, Atlanta, and Nashville.
So my question is, how did Academy voters actually even hear about or know about this film? And I can tell you this. The song was written by the former head of the Academy's music division. So,
well, and he's done film composing, of course, Bruce Broughton. He's done lots of movies, Silverado and Tombstone and a number of other movies.
Right. And he did a very good campaign of getting on his horse, no pun intended, to beat the drum for this particular song and this particular entry. And it worked.
Good for him. Did he? I wonder if he's a born again Christian.
I have no idea.
Yeah, interesting. So, yeah, so that's, obviously U2 is a force to reckon with from Mandela Long Walk to Freedom. That was a movie people thought might get some momentum and get an acting nomination, but no such luck. So that's in there. Will Frozen, the classic song from a classic sort of Hollywood animated film / musical, be the one to beat it out, or will the power of U2 win everybody over? It's not a given, but I would still put my money on the song from Frozen.
And do you think that Arcade Fire or Will Butler and Owen Pallett will win for score? They were nominated for Her. Or will it be Alexandra Desplat for Philomena or Thomas Newman for Saving Mr. Banks?
Well, that's interesting because it's wide open, obviously.
Yeah.
None of the movies are going to win Best Picture unless you think Gravity pulls it off. I think we can rule out The Book Thief.
Yes.
I don't remember the music from Gravity, so I'm going to rule that out. I don't know if you do.
Yeah, more so than others, but I think the music from Her will probably win.
Well, that's what we hope. I think it's more our affection for it is what you're hoping. I don't think it's a given. Alexander Desplat has been nominated a lot. I don't know if he's actually won. Thomas Newman also has been nominated a lot. I'm not sure if he's ever won. So their names have been around a number of years, sort of waiting their turn, and they might just pull it off there. But this category is unquestionably wide open. I wouldn't rule anything out except maybe The Book Thief. I think they might be too embarrassed to give it to John Williams for that, but you never know.
Now, a category I don't think that is wide open is Best Visual Effects. I think Gravity takes this in a heartbeat, even though it's up against The Hobbit,
well,
Desolation of
Smaug. It will win almost all the tech awards.
Yes, I agree.
Absolutely. So those are the categories. There are lots of other little categories to play around with. Best editing is always one to keep an eye on because that's a great tip. If you don't get nominated for best editing, you're not going to win best picture. That's the rule of thumb that goes out there. But there's a lot of fun to play with. And of course, the big news is that split, the PGA awards going to both 12 Years a Slave and Gravity. That's crazy. We've never seen that before. And this Saturday, we have the DGA Awards. They're the best of the guilds. You've got the Producers Guild, you've got the Acting Guild, and you've got the Directors Guild. They are the best at predicting Best Picture. In their history, they have the best track record of giving their top award, which is Best Director, and naming that for the film that wins Best Picture. It doesn't mean they name the best director necessarily, but they do have the best track record of giving their top award to a film that will win the Oscar for Best Picture. So that happens on Saturday. Keep your eyes open for that. That's another hint about this horse race between these three films and who's going to come out on top. And of course, right now out on top is Sperling. Are you on top of a mountain? You're at Sundance. I don't know if it's, are you on a hill or a mountain? Are you in a valley? I don't even know what Sundance is.
What? You know what Sundance is. It's probably the premier film festival in at least the United States. I guess North America, you'd have to include Toronto in that. But it's one of the largest film festivals in the world. I would say Sundance, Toronto, Cannes, Venice, Berlin are, they're all up there.
No, I just meant, are you on in a valley? Are you down low? Are you up high? What's it like?
I'm at the Park City Mountain Resort right now, so I am up high.
All right. So you're having there. How does it feel? Is attendance good? Is it a good year? How's the vibe? How's the momentum?
Well, you know, we were just talking about, and we didn't talk about the SAG Awards, but American Hustle won there.
Well, we did. We mentioned that they won Best Picture.
And I would say that, you know, the interesting thing about coming to Park City, Utah in January for the Sundance Film Festival is that on January 16th of this year was the first day of the festival. It was also when the Academy Award nominations were announced.
And Robert Redford was snubbed.
He was, yes, snubbed, as we've decided we should or should not say. And he talked about that and about how the release pattern of the film and the way that Roadside Attractions released the film really affected its chances, not only for him as an awards contender, but commercially, which was more important.
He said, I'm not offended, but boy, did they blew the Oscar campaign.
Right. Exactly. And the campaign for the film. But the interesting thing is it's Sundance is a place where documentaries are they've kind of grown up and become front and center. They've really attracted a lot of attention here. And every year the documentaries are fantastic up here. They attract a lot of attention. And if you look at Best Documentary Feature, I would say almost all of these films, The Square, Cutie and the Boxer, The Act of Killing, all of these films, 20 Feet from Stardom, opened last year's festival. They are all films that, at least most of these films, got their start here at Sundance.
And moving on from Michael Moore, I would say, is probably one of the good markers, but they've actually become commercial forces. They're all making $20, $30 million, but they can make $5 million, $7 million. That's a huge difference from, you know, 30 years ago, 40, when they just didn't even release documentaries into the theaters. You know, they were rarely seen.
That is absolutely true. I mean, Hoop Dreams is being shown here, I believe, later today, an anniversary screening. And Steve James has a film up here this year, and he was the filmmaker on Hoop Dreams. And
he has the Roger Ebert film, right?
Life Itself, yes.
That's right, a film about Roger Ebert, filmed while he got his diagnosis of cancer, right? I mean, that happened during the making of the film, didn't it?
I believe so, yes. I'm seeing that later today.
Roger found out, he's announced in the middle of the making of the film, I'm not going to see this film ever be released. So that's very touching, very sad. I mean, Roger Ebert, obviously a fixture in film criticism, but that's one of the big movies there. Have you seen anything yet that you really love?
Well, you know, if we could just stick with documentaries for a second, because you mentioned that they're being released now. And we saw, you know, the Crash Reel about the snowboarding did quite well last year. Blackfish was here last year and was on CNN and got a lot of buzz. This year, as far as documentaries go, Alive Inside by Michael Rosada Bennett is a film about how music therapy is helping people with Alzheimer's and how nobody's taking it seriously because it's music therapy and how it's not a drug. How could it be anything? You know, you can't really use music to heal dementia or treat dementia. And it's a very interesting, touching, straightforward documentary. Bring a box of Kleenex. I believe next year you will be seeing, or throughout the rest of this year, you'll be seeing a lot about this film.
I'm sure they don't say that it heals dementia. I'm sure they say that
that's
helps ameliorate, slows the decline, etc.
Yes.
But anyway.
I did not mean, yes.
Okay.
Another documentary, Katie Couric produced a documentary on obesity and the food industry called Fed Up, which was, again, straightforward, but important in kind of underscoring what it is we're eating these days.
Is it a good documentary? You make it sound like it's public health service announcement. Is it a good film? Is it just important? I don't want to hear important. That's boring. Is it actually good and entertaining, or is it just something you should show on PBS?
It's more something you should show on Dateline.
Okay.
Now, speaking of which, okay, a film that I walked out of, I didn't know whether I liked it or whether it was good or not, is a film, and I can always tell when the film is actually good, when it sticks with me. And this film, The Overnighters, is a film that has everything going on in the United States right now, in North America right now. It has income disparity. It has homelessness. It's got the energy problem and the environment.
What about me not being able to get a date? Does it have that in there as well?
As a matter of fact, it does. That, you know, it's got the gay issues and the marriage issue. It's got everything going on, and it's about immigration. It's got migrancy. It's about all of these men effectively moving to a small town in North Dakota for these jobs in the oil fields. And North Dakota has minted more millionaires in the past year or two than any other state in the United States. So there's all these people flocking there for jobs, leaving their families, leaving their homes, coming from other states, but there's no place to house these people. There's no place for them to stay. And so this pastor in this town has started to house them in his church and in the parking lot, and it's how the town reacts to that and how he's trying to fight for them. But it takes a lot of different turns, and I'm not going to spoil anything, but it's got a real hitch at the end.
But you weren't sure what you thought of it, so it's sort of a mixed bag, but it's sort of interesting enough to pull you in?
Yes, absolutely.
All right. Well, you know, every year at Sundance, they say, oh, we're getting back to our indie roots. We're getting back to our indie roots. And this year, in fact, Redford said it's really gotten away from him, and it's not what it used to be, and he doesn't like the commercialism. He likes the spirit of indie, and they tried to say yet again, this is the year we're returning to our indie roots. So is it true, or just the thing that they're going to say every 3 years until they give up pretending it's ever going to happen again?
Well, you know, it's funny because years ago, the films in the documentary competition, few of them had, you know, big actors. And this year, The Lowdown has John Hawkes and Elle Fanning. I saw Whiplash, which is a great film. It opened the festival. It stars Miles Teller as a drummer, and he's in a music conservancy, and he's trying to join the jazz band. And the leader of the jazz band, the teacher, is J.K. Simmons or Simmons. I never know whether to say Simmons or Simmons, who plays a drill sergeant. I mean, he is phenomenal in this film and kind of brutal to this to Miles Teller's character. And I kind of called it Rocky with drums, and people kind of laughed at that. They kind of said, "Oh, it's kind of a good description." It's a great film, and yet those are two fairly well-known actors at this point, or at least, you know, up and coming for Miles Teller. And so I would say, has it returned to its indie roots? Yes, to some extent, but also it's a different kind of indie root.
Well, it just feels less commercial, or how does it feel indie to you?
The films are at times subjects that wouldn't ordinarily be made by a studio.
Mm-hmm.
They are far more commercial in their nature in terms of being marketable.
Slicker, more professional, but they're just still films that are offbeat enough the studio wouldn't make them.
Correct. I mean, one of the films up here this year is by Zach Braff. Now, you might recall, we've talked about this film before. It's called Wish I Was Here. It stars Zach Braff and now Josh Gad. His name escaped me for a second. And
it's his first directorial effort since Garden State, which made a good amount of money, had a hit soundtrack, got tons of critical acclaim, and the fact that he couldn't get this movie made by any mini or major studio is bizarre.
Right.
And he went around to Kickstarter.
That's right. And it was a bit controversial. He got a lot of flack for it, but it premiered here, and he's proving everybody wrong. I mean, it's a decent film. So is Obvious Child. Now, here's a you know, really, there's all these sections, documentary section, U.S. Drama competition section, and then there's the New Frontier section, which are experimental films. The section in which a lot of good content is coming from is Next. It's micro-budget type movies, although it started out micro-budget a couple years ago. Now, it too is, you start looking at these films and say, so your micro-budget of $5 million was, that's micro-budget? But a film that is causing a lot of stir is Obvious Child by Gillian Robespierre. It stars Jenny Slate, an actress who I believe is on Saturday Night Live, or was a cast member on Saturday Night Live. And it's a very funny abortion comedy, believe it or not, is the way I would describe it.
Well, what about the panels? Have you seen any good panels? Have you attended anything that was interesting?
I have. And actually, this is a panel. It was called Lessons Learned. It was moderated by Jason Hirshhorn. He is the CEO and chief curator of Rediff, Media Rediff, is his
chief curator. Okay, whatever.
Well, I mean, it's his daily newsletter is worth getting. He, of course, used to be the head of MySpace and was the chief digital officer over at MTV Networks for a while. But he moderated a panel called Lessons Learned about how creators can get their work out there, how that world is changing, and what the past had and what the future holds. And the people on it, and I guess I'll go in the order that they listed them here on the sheet of paper that I'm holding.
You don't need to list them all.
Well, you'll see why I'm doing that. Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who had his web series Hit Record, which is now a television series.
Hit Record.
Hit Record. Chet and I apologize, Kanoggia, Chet Kanoggia. He is the founder of a little company that got a huge cheer when he announced what it was doing and what had come of it. He's the CEO of Aereo, being sued by 17 different broadcast networks. Bob Mozlowski, he is the head of music for Twitter. He used to work at Topspin Media. And Evan Ratliff, who is a journalist, but also the co-founder and editor of Atavist, which is kind of a software company that produces these long-form news stories that you can pay for as one-offs. And it was a fascinating panel that really what came out of it was you have to curate, if you will, or build your own audience and monetize that audience in levels of margin. So your closest fans, your biggest fans, the ones that are will pay for anything you do, you want to have a direct commercial relationship with them. You want to sell directly to them. But then those people will go out and talk to their friends. And their friends are going to turn to Amazon or iTunes or other sources. And you're going to have a commercial relationship with those consumers through another source, through a distributor. And so it was really about that type of business that's going on now. I guess really, in a way, it was the perfect panel to attend because there has never been a better time to be a filmmaker in the world, really, because there are so many different avenues to get your film out there, whether it's Tug, whether it's Assemble, whether it's Kickstarter or Indiegogo or Gravitas or VHX or Topspin Media. I mean, there's all these ways to reach audiences and different platforms. Netflix, of course, is a given. All these different ways to find distribution that didn't exist even 3 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, no, it's there's online and streaming and digital downloads and, you know, so many different sites, and they all want content, even if you're just a website, certainly if you're a channel. So there's certainly a lot more avenues to get your film out to people than ever before. You can just post it for free on YouTube if you want.
Yeah, and actually YouTube is up here in a major way. Vimeo is not up here, at least I haven't seen them up here, but ironically, a lot of the filmmakers are using Vimeo to distribute their films professionally to whether it's publicists or journalists. They send out a Vimeo link with a password. So Vimeo is here in spirit, if not actually physically. You know, really not only distribution is being changed by this, and because there are so many different ways to distribute your film, there's a lot more content reaching audiences. So you may laugh at curation, Michael, but curation is going to become incredibly important moving forward.
I'm not laughing at curation. I'm laughing at that title.
Ah, okay. Chief curator.
Chief curator is just a silly title.
Okay. Well, head curator? I don't know. but not only are there numerous ways to distribute content and in a much more viable way and less expensive way, but making films has never been easier or less expensive. It is the cost of production has come down to such an extent that the types of films that we're seeing now, they probably wouldn't have been funded in years past. And what's better and what's even more interesting is that they look phenomenal. All of these films that in years past would have been shot on HD cam or beta.
They would have had that indie aesthetic with sort of, you know, cheap looking video sort of feel to it and sort of low budget, lo-fi, mumblecore-y sort of, you know, haphazard feel.
Right. And now you have these films that are shot on a $5,000 camera, which is, yeah, that's an expensive camera, but it's not a $150,000 camera and you're not running film through it at a rate that costs you, you know, $20,000 a minute. So it's unbelievable some of the cinematography that we're seeing in these movies, and it's both good and bad. You know, sometimes the films are a little longer than they should be because they were able to shoot so much, these filmmakers. But I think it's very interesting to see the aesthetic that's coming out of these types of movies, almost so much so that it's almost too crisp. You almost want to say, hey, turn down the HD-ness of your film.
So overall, you'd say Sundance this year has been a big deal?
I would say it's been a big deal, and I know you want to move us on to Big Deal or Big Whoop.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, I just want to, before we move on, I would say one documentary that you may hear a lot about down the road is Dinosaur 13. It's the documentary about finding Sue, the largest Tyrannosaurus Rex fossil ever found. And I don't know, I found it an adequate movie with a story, fascinating story, convoluted story. But it got picked up here, so it's going to be on CNN, I believe.
Well, big deal if it's adequate. Why, you know,
Well, the reason I say that is because it to me is the epitome of the entire festival. There are some great films here, and there are some okay films here, but it's
and
mostly
they're all getting picked up.
It's mostly okay.
Well, that's the way it is at every festival, right?
I don't know. Some years you see one film after another where you're like, wow, I can't believe I saw that film. That, you know, The Sessions and Beasts of the Southern Wild and, you know, one right after the other, or Blue Valentine and Winter's Bone. I saw those two films back to back on the same night where you're like, think, wow, this is phenomenal. You know, these are great films. Whereas this year, that hasn't happened so much.
Well, it's only the first weekend, right? And have you seen the Richard Linklater film Boyhood? That was the movie shot over a 12-year period, where he used the same child actor to chart the story of a child's adolescence, and he literally filmed like for 4 or 5 days a year over 12 different years, which is kind of fascinating.
I did not see that film. It played this morning because I was A, prepping for our recording here, and B, I went to see a movie called Happy Christmas, which is kind of in the mumblecore genre. It was shot on film, ironically. It's 78 minutes long. That might explain why it's so short, and it stars Anna Kendrick and Lena Dunham, and it's kind of a character piece.
All right.
But you wanted to move on to Big Deal or Big Whoop, which is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, what's the number one network show during the day? Do you know, Michael? Is it The View? Is it The Talk? One of the few remaining soaps, maybe? Nope. It's The Price is Right with Drew Carey. Come on down. It averages 3 million viewers a day.
So I had no idea.
Yeah, it's no surprise that CBS renewed it for another season. But at the same time, they renewed their entire daytime lineup, which includes two game shows, the other being Let's Make a Deal, two soaps, The Young and the Restless and The Bold and the Beautiful, and one chat show, which is The Talk. It's up 19%, by the way, The Talk, from last year, and reaches 2.8 million viewers each day. That's a lot in the middle of the day. Since CBS is up in total viewers and female demos, is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. You could see it coming. Change comes slowly in daytime, and that's why The Talk growing and growing is a big surprise. You know, it's taken a long time, but it was such a bald imitation of The View, and now it's really becoming a challenger to The View. I don't know what The View is averaging, but obviously it's less than 3 million, so they must be in a tight horse race. The only thing that surprised me more than the fact that The Price is Right is number one is that Let's Make a Deal is still on the air. I had no idea.
Neither did I. Now, we talked a lot about Frozen earlier in the show, but ever since the first reviews of the movie Frozen were published, critics have described the movie as Broadway-ready. So it's not really surprising that Disney has confirmed they will indeed be turning their smash hit Frozen into a stage musical, though no time frame has been announced. Bob Iger describes the film as hugely important to Disney, I'd say $1 billion of importance, and not just as a commercial hit, of course. Frozen and Tangled make clear Disney animation is back on track and not overshadowed by this little upstart company, what's it called again? The one that Steve Jobs
Pixar.
Was a part of. Pixar, yes. Plus, Frozen has spun off to... Now, you knew I actually knew the name there, right? You
didn't think?
Okay, just checking. Frozen has spun off toys, a hit soundtrack, and other merchandise. That's not surprising. And not to mention, by the way, future iterations. You know there's going to be theme park rides and the like. Because when Disney has a hit with legs, they can exploit it in countless ways throughout its TV, theme park, radio empire, in ways most other studios can't even imagine. ESPN may add the most to Disney's bottom line, by the way, but as Fortune put it, Fortune magazine, animated films keep the studio's heart pumping. I could not agree more. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big whoop. I don't know that it's necessarily going to make a good musical. I liked the movie pretty good. I thought the songs were pretty good. The characters were pretty good. It was better than I expected. It wasn't great. I liked Tangled better, I think. But I was really fascinated by Bob Iger and his interview with Fortune, where he talked about how important this movie is, not just as a commercial success, but like really how it's important to the DNA of the Disney empire that a Disney animated film, a traditional Disney animated film, as opposed to even Pixar, which has really taken over, and it's the guys at Pixar who are in charge that helped make this movie a success. So there's really no division anymore between those two areas, but they really work separately on their films. Pixar people work on their film, and the Disney animated people have their own division, and the people overlooking them, the twain don't meet. So it's not like it's all blurred and anybody goes back and forth. They really are separate divisions, and the Disney division had this big success. It follows up Tangled, and he really made clear how important it is just emotionally and somehow spiritually to like the Disney empire. And you don't think of a company that way, but it sort of makes sense. They got a long tradition with animated films, and to have this one be such a big hit is really, really important to them.
Well, I think Julie Taymor should definitely try and direct this because with, you know, she should get like a huge budget to do all the snow inside and all the ice and snow. That would be just fun, you know, try and top Spider-Man.
The audience would have to put on parkas when they go into the theater.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, and if you've ever been on, you know, to the theme parks or on one of their cruises, there is no doubt animation and the successful animated titles for Disney are super important. Now, apparently, it's not only Duck Hunters who can get into hot water for talking in petty terms about gay people. So can sexy bachelors on the ABC reality show, The Bachelor. Juan Pablo Galavis? Is that how you pronounce his name?
Just call him Juan Pablo.
Juan Pablo. He is the first person of color to be seeking true love, at least on The Bachelor, and he's also the first one to say dumb stuff. Asked if he ever thought ABC might show a gay person trying to find romance instead of just saying, who knows? Juan Pablo said he had many gay friends and they're more of a perverted and maybe that wasn't good for the kids on the TV. He didn't say it that way. I just made that up. ABC immediately condemned the comments and said it didn't reflect their views or the show. And Galavis apologized, or Juan Pablo apologized, and said English is his second language and maybe he didn't phrase it properly, but he loves the perverts. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop because ABC has handled it, I think, the right way. They didn't run out and say, we're going to cancel the show and take them off. They just said, we condemn it. It's not true. He apologized, said he didn't phrase himself. You know, we'll see if it has any traction. I doubt it would because it's just not the same level of bigotry involved. He just said, I don't think gay people would make a good TV show. People couldn't watch it. It's too intense. They're too sexual. And it would be a bad role model for children. You know, whatever. So I think they handled it the right way. If it gains legs or whatever, I don't think it was something that he should have been, you know, he's the star of the show. They can't end the reality show without him. It's already been filmed. So what are they going to do? They just said it's wrong. We condemn it. We don't like it. He make him apologize and hopefully it all goes away. And I'm talking about how they crisis controlled it. I'm not talking about it as an ethical or moral issue. I'm just saying, how did they handle it as a business? And I think they've done the right thing.
Now, in their statement, did they end it with The Bachelor, Tuesdays, 8 p.m.?
Yeah, probably. And we love the pervert.
Right. Now, Fleetwood Mac is back. Christine McVie.
Don't stop thinking about tomorrow.
Certainly Christine McVie didn't. She has been retired for many years in England, not even interested in stepping into the studio to record a new track or two for any of the band's studio albums. She was done. Done, I say. Stevie Nicks said the chances of her returning to the lineup were, well, nil. Until McVie changed her mind, that is. McVie joined the group on stage recently and had such a good time, she made clear she was ready to return. If they would invite me back, McVie said, she would be thrilled. Well, hell, said Nix. She started the group. Why not? Come on back. She can come back anytime. Now, after 16 years, McVie is rejoining one of the most successful groups, music groups, that is, of all time. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal because they're going to lose money.
What?
Well, because Stevie Nicks, Lindsey Buckingham, Mick Fleetwood, and the other guy, John McVie, they're going to have to take a pay cut because they've been hugely successful on the road, even without Christine McVie. So bringing her back into the group is not just some, hey, we need to get the original lineup so people, you know, they've been hugely successful. So they're taking a pay cut. So that's how much they really like her and mean to her and want to have the original group together. Because it wasn't, you know, some sort of thing, hey, let's get the original Styx lineup or the original Journey. Let's get them back together where you can goose your receipts on the road. They didn't need any goosing. So this was really, truly an act of love and appreciation and wanting to have the full lineup there because that's where they're making their money now. They don't make money on album sales anymore.
No.
So that's kind of a fascinating thing. They're like, yes, come back. Oh, man, we're going to make less money.
Right.
But I'm excited. They haven't had a studio album in 10 years. I don't know why, even though she was retired, why she wouldn't at least go in the studio and record a track or two, you know, like at least stay part of the group in the studio. But she's done. And now she's back. So maybe we'll get an actual Fleetwood Mac album with some new tunes, including ones by Christine McVie.
Well, speaking of coming back, it looks like Art Garfunkel is coming back.
That's right. A Simon & Garfunkel tour was canceled because his voice got shot. He had an issue, and it's apparently recovered. He had treatment. It's recovered. He's going to do a solo tour to work his voice out again. It sounds like his voice is back and he's ready to sing again. So that's nice to see.
Well, speaking of Paul Simon, you know, I like his album, Rhythm of the Saints. I believe it was released in 1990, 91, somewhere in that time frame. And the first track on the album is Obvious Child, I believe. And,
yes.
And that's the, you know, up here at Sundance, the film Obvious Child has that song in it. Now, it's a song I hadn't heard probably in 15 years. And exactly. Lots of drums, and it's a catchy little tune. Now, and I thought, oh, Obvious Child, yeah, you know, it makes sense. Now, I hadn't heard that song in 15 years, and I heard it one night in Obvious Child. The very next night in Zach Braff's film, the same song is used.
Yeah.
What are the chances?
That's hilarious.
Now, the chances of a network going off of cable or satellite are a lot higher, because in the latest showdown between TV providers and a network, DirecTV has dropped the Weather Channel from its lineup. It's about money, of course. The Weather Channel insists it was just asking for a reasonable rate above its current 13 cents per subscriber, maybe like $1, $1.20. I made that last part up. But DirecTV said, bye-bye. CBS had the upcoming NFL season to prod Time Warner Cable into action. I don't think the Weather Channel has, I don't know, a hurricane or something that they could prod.
Well, but that's exactly what they're probably rooting for.
Right. I mean, does this mean the Weather Channel has to root for, as you say, a hurricane or some other major weather event to remind viewers of how much they miss it? Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. They don't have a lot of leverage. It's not a channel that people turn to, except probably in extreme weather. They want people to come to them more and more. They've just hired Sam Champion away from ABC's Good Morning America, the number one morning show, to be the face of the Weather Channel and give them a better, you know, a better presence in people's lives. They think, oh, yes, the Weather Channel, you know, make it personal, make it real, someone they can identify with. So they're investing a lot of money in him. Half their revenue comes from their subscriber base, meaning that money they get paid by cable providers. Half of their $320, $330 million comes from that. The other half is advertising. And if they're off, not only would they lose some of that revenue from subscribers, but their advertising revenue will drop as well because they're not as reaching as many homes. So it's a really bad situation for the Weather Channel. And I'm worried because, by God, it's going to snow tomorrow and I don't know what to do.
Turn on CNN.
Oh, okay.
So, Michael, do you want the good news or the bad news?
I want the good news.
Okay, here's the good news then. Aaron Sorkin's The Newsroom has been renewed by HBO for a third season.
Oh, that's great. So what's the bad news?
The bad news is that the third season will be the last.
Oh.
So HBO renewed it and canceled it at the same time. They basically said,
I love you and I want a divorce.
Yeah, come back, but only stay for a while. You can stay a week, but then you're going to have to find your own place. I've got more good news, by the way. The Emmy-winning Justified was renewed.
Yeah.
For a sixth season. Yes, for a sixth season.
That's great.
The bad news is that it, too, will be saying goodbye. Though the decision came from the show's creator, Graham Yost, and star Timothy Oliphant, Californication, which is the David Duchovny show, is also in the midst of its seventh and final season. Is this trend a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. It's kind of fascinating. People realize you can't not just pull the plug. If you have any possibility, it's better to say in advance, you know what? This is the last year because of DVD sales, and let them wind up a show, especially with shows with continuing storylines. You want to give them a chance to end it right because that makes it more valuable when you have the complete series box set, when you have people streaming it online, when you have people downloading it. It just makes it a more valuable property to know there's going to be an actual end. So give them the chance to say goodbye. So even if you're cutting off maybe half a season early or extending an extra 8 episodes when normally you would have said, oh, we're done with it, it's a smart thing to do. It's a smart thing to do for the long-term value of a show. I think we're going to see this. We're already seeing a lot more. I think it's just the wave of the future. A sitcom, it doesn't matter. You can, whatever, goodbye. But for any sort of serialized drama, it's a disaster to cut it off when you don't have a chance to wind it up. So if there's any chance of saying when you're going to end it, they're going to do it more and more.
Neil Young had a multi-night stand at Carnegie Hall, just him and a row of guitars and more than 5 decades of songs. Yeah, he had a little bit of a library to go through. The reviews were, the word that I'm looking for is, yeah, they were ecstatic, actually, for the first night, and the raves just kept coming in after that. Rolling Stone said ushers were more vigilant than usual about people recording on their phones, but of course, video leaked out anyway. They did a rundown of the 10 must-see bootleg videos from the show. This follows in the wake of Rolling Stone deciding a number of years ago to regularly review bootleg audio recordings of concerts, album outtakes, and the like. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop because it's I think it's the way to go. I think you'll see even like the New York Times and other people doing it. How can you ignore stuff that all your readers are accessing? Rolling Stone just looks stupid if they didn't start reviewing bootlegs, because that's what people were talking about. And now, I mean, it was kind of shocking. The concert happened and 3 days later saying, hey, link to all these great videos of the concert. They're bootlegs. They're stealing. Maybe Neil Young wants to release a concert film or an album. And they're immediately released, you know, linking to illegal, you know, postings of video from the show that Neil Young wouldn't even want. And I'm sure at some point they had to decide, even if the artist is annoyed, we got to cover this stuff because it's what fans care about. And we look stupid if we ignore it. And some other site's going to cover it. And that's where people will go. So it's just a reflection of you've got to accept reality and what's going on online if you want to keep your business fresh and smart.
Here in the United States, there is a satellite radio provider called a Sirius XM. And there is a channel on that. You know, there's like 100 and some odd channels. That's the E Street Radio. So it's just Bruce Springsteen and Bruce Springsteen type music. And
I had a dream last night that I sang in concert with the E Street Band. Bruce went off stage. I swear to God, I just remembered this. And I'm on stage and I'm singing some song of it. I'm like, give me the horns. And then the horns came in with a big riff. And I just remembered that. Man, that was fun.
Well,
that sounded great.
Well, if you did that now, and if that actually happened at a future Bruce Springsteen concert, not only would there be a bootleg, but it would be an official bootleg, because like Pearl Jam before him, Bruce Springsteen has decided that there are all these bootleg recordings that get aired on E Street Radio, and I suppose with his permission, but you can hear like people clapping and talking in the background, because the recorder was obviously out in the middle of the audience somewhere. Somebody had brought in a recorder, and it's a bootleg copy. And he's saying, you know what? We're going to do it officially. Every show will be recorded, and you could buy the show afterwards. It's a smart move.
Right, because, I mean, Pearl Jam was doing it with releasing a CD, and they would just release every show on CD. But that gets sort of cumbersome. This, as a digital download, is so easy to do. They've always recorded every Springsteen show, and yet they've been very sparse in releasing official live recordings. In this case, they're just going to say, we'll make a digital audio download available for every show. If you want to, you know, you can't even call it a bootleg. If you want to copy of the concert you attended, go out and buy it. Or if you hear suddenly, wow, that show in Ireland was great, you can go out and buy it right away. It's why not do it?
And like
you say,
agree.
It's like the panel at Sundance. The people who are fanatic for you, they're not going to buy every show because there's too many shows. But when you have fanatic fans who are going to hear like, oh, December 5th in Oakland was tremendous, they want to buy it. They'll happily pay for it. You just got to give them a chance to do it. So you get to directly sell it to them and make a lot of money. Maybe I'm a more casual fan, and maybe once a year or 2 years, you release the best show from a tour, the best bootleg, and then that will be available via Amazon or maybe even a Barnes & Noble store. And I, as a more casual fan, would go in and buy that. But, you know, that's what you got to do. Monetize the hardcore fans, give them a chance to do it legally, and they'll happily pay you for it.
Yeah, and Pearl Jam started out on CDs, but they eventually switched over to digital downloads. And if you wanted the CD, you had to pay extra.
Sure.
You know, a Zoe Saldana film up here at Sundance is doing quite well. It's called Infinitely Polar Bear. Lots of buzz around that film. The two star, and of course, Zoe Saldana stars in Avatar, where she starred in Avatar. But guess what? She's going to star in the next 2, 3, 4, however many sequels there are.
Three.
Well, the two stars of Avatar, the highest grossing film of all time, remember, Michael, they have both signed on for the sequels. Director James Cameron is making three films at once, as you just mentioned, a la Lord of the Rings. He's turning his Avatar franchise into a quartet of films. Oh, I like that, Michael. We were wondering how to, it's not a trilogy, it's a, what is it? I like a quartet. That's pretty good. Saldana has had far more success on her own, snagging a key role in the Star Trek franchise and the TV miniseries Rosemary's Baby, among others, especially like the film up here at Sundance. Worthington starred in Clash of the Titans and its sequel, two of the worst reviewed movies in ages. It's no mystery why they signed on, both Saldana and Worthington, but what is unknown is what they were paid.
Ooh, I'd love to see that contract. Oh, I would love to see that contract.
Big deal. Or big whoop?
Big whoop, because they'd both be insane not to say yes. And I know Chris Pine is going, hey, Zoe, how you doing? You got any good roles in Avatar for me?
Yeah, exactly. I know I'm the star of this movie, but you're actually, can I come over and like, you
can
know?
Can we hang out?
Yeah, exactly. Now, you can slice the numbers for American Idol a lot of different ways, but clearly the show is past its prime. It was down 16% from last year's premiere in total viewers, and down a terrible 23%, the key demo 18 to 49, that key 18 to 49 demo, gotta love it. In fact, Idol has been getting older and older and older in its audience for years. On the other
hand, if only I would stop growing up.
Well,
It's partly my fault.
Yes, I agree. Stop eating. On the other hand, it was up from last season's finale, so people are still checking it out, I guess. And it's bigger in total viewers than the most recent premiere of The Voice. And it gave Fox its biggest ratings of the season outside of sports and the Golden Globes. Now we'll have to see if the feel-good vibe from Jennifer Lopez, Keith Urban, and goofball Harry Connick Jr. is enough to bring more people back. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal because it's the number one show on Fox at the moment. I mean, wow. You know, that tells you how far Fox has fallen. They need some new big hits to power themselves up because American Idol is graying and it's still their biggest hit.
Well, let's stick with Fox for a second. Kevin Reilly, the head of Fox, got a lot of mileage out of his talk to reporters at an annual event to drum up interest in TV. Reilly said his, and that's the TCAs, by the way, the Television Critics Association press tour. Reilly said his network was done with pilot season, the brief period when every network tries to cast and shoot pilots for their upcoming projects. And by done, he did not mean, you know, oh, we're through it. We've completed it. He meant we're not doing it anymore. Heck, Fox is practically done with pilots altogether. In fact, essentially, he'll make commitments to series year-round to improve their chances of getting the best talent. And they'll go right ahead with plans for the show for an entire series rather than viewing for waiting for a pilot and then a green light weeks before the show has to start airing episodes. Forget the fall premiere week while you're at it. He doesn't like that either. And will someone please do something about the ratings? Nielsen is broken, he says, because they're missing too many viewers. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, he thinks it's a big deal. Most of the other networks said it's a big whoop because they're like, well, we like pilot season. It creates a sense of excitement and drama and creativity and juices are flowing and everybody knows to be available so that they can shoot a pilot. You know, so there is the tradition of pilot season where people head out to L.A., make themselves available and can appear in two or three or four and then see which one gets picked up. So, you know, there are pluses and minuses to both ways, but it's very clear that, you know, business as usual just doesn't cut it anymore. The more elaborate the show, the more likely you are to greenlight it in advance and not wait for a pilot because you just can't. You need to staff people. You need to work on scripts. You need to work on shooting schedules. It's very complicated. And TV shows are more and more like movies every day. So you don't have the luxury of just waiting for pilot season and doing that sort of old-fashioned way. So there you go. I think he makes some good points. I don't think it works for everyone or for every project. There is some benefit to the fall TV, you know, launch and to the pilot season and those sort of concerted moments where everybody pays attention, whether it's in the industry or in the media. And, you know, you can see the arguments for both.
NBC has announced the follow-up to its live TV performance of The Sound of Music. It's going to be Peter Pan and will air on December 4th, 2014, almost certainly with a male in the role of the boy who wouldn't grow up.
Sorry, Carrie Underwood.
That's yes. It's a homecoming of sorts since NBC aired a live performance of Peter Pan back in 1955 with Broadway star Mary Martin in the title role. It reaches a massive 65 million viewers and was rebroadcast multiple times. And that was the 1955 version of Peter Pan. Presumably, it's that musical version they'll be tackling. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. You know, it's a smart thing to do. It's a good choice. Everybody was wondering, who would they pick as their next show? They wanted something that made sense, family-friendly, very familiar, but not done to death. And I assume it's the musical version of this Peter Pan that we're talking about, because there's a lot of different versions. I assume they've gotten the rights to that particular version, not the horrible Disney animated film version, which is terrible. But, I mean, Peter Pan is a perennial. There's a new live-action version that'll be coming out in 2015. So the following summer, there'll be a new live-action version. So, you know, it makes sense. And when you look back to 1955, our population was half the size it was now. It's about 150 million people. So when you figure almost half of them were watching that special, that was a hugely big and successful special.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week, and it's time for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This week, how could we have any other story than this one? Because boy, will this affect every single person in the world. And granted, this is a story that is taking place here in the United States, but every internet service provider around the world is watching how this plays out. Because if internet providers here in the U.S. get away with throttling and charging for, I guess, exclusive
Prime access,
access, everybody's going to do it. And if, what happened? Is there was a split decision that was struck down. Really, it's a blow against net neutrality. the FCC, in my opinion, kind of screwed up here, but the court said that because of the way the FCC has classified internet service providers in the service, and that includes cable
because
companies.
Because of the way Congress did.
Sorry, yes, the way Congress did. I thought it was the FCC.
No, it's Congress. They said Congress said it's not a utility. Because it's not a utility, they don't have the same oversight that they do. They didn't say they don't have any oversight, but they say, in fact, they do have some oversight powers, but it's not a utility. And therefore, some people say, well, neither side got what they wanted. But in fact, the FCC doesn't seem that focused on net neutrality. The Obama administration's head of the FCC said, well, we want to encourage innovation and experimentation, which means letting people charge extra to make your website come through quicker. Explain what we're talking about when we say net neutrality. Right now, net neutrality is like a telephone call. Somebody calls you, the call comes to your phone. That's it.
Yeah,
it
they
doesn't
do,
matter
in other words,
if, where the phone call comes from or who it is or who's placing the call. Is it a business? Is it personal? Is it from around the world? It just comes to you. But that's the way websites work. You go to a website, it comes to you as quickly as it can via your internet provider. Now, if you get rid of net neutrality, that means the New York Times can pay extra to say, I want my website to load faster. And that means any new website or any smaller website, an upstart, could take half a minute to load or a minute. You know, they're not paying. And so why should your internet provider make it easier for them? So if somebody called you on your phone and they weren't paying extra money to come to you quick, it might take longer for that call to go through and take longer for you to answer it. And so a business that's paying extra gets to dominate phone calls, gets to dominate the internet, get through to you quicker. And it just makes the rich richer, the poor poorer, and makes it a lot harder for new people to establish themselves online because the big guys will have big money and be able to make their websites bigger and more dominant than ever.
Right. Really, this all boils down to the common carrier clause of this of the statute here. And it's when you are a common carrier, like telephone companies are, you're a utility and you can't prioritize traffic. You can't prioritize what you're delivering.
Right. Yeah, you can't say what you like or don't like.
Right. Or if somebody pays you more, you say, I like you more. You know, Mr. Obama, Mr. President, you're paying me more to run your phone calls. I'm going to put your calls through before Mrs. Smith down the street. And likewise, the internet and the pipes that feed the internet have been dumb pipes. You could shape traffic, but you couldn't really throttle a lot of traffic.
Couldn't pick and choose.
Right. What this court ruling, which was the Ninth Circuit, not Ninth Circuit, but it was an appeals court in Washington, D.C., what they said was because internet service providers are not considered common carriers, they do not have to follow that same rule. They don't have to be neutral. However, so what does that mean? So what are all of these internet service providers going to do? Comcast, because they purchased NBC Universal, in the agreement with the Justice Department, allowing them to purchase NBC Universal, they agreed for 7 years to not throttle any traffic, no matter what the laws were. No matter what
the
laws
are. Their hands are tied for the next 5 or 6 years, no matter what happens with this case, which will clearly go to the Supreme Court.
Well, here's the thing. The FCC was the plaintiff. Yes, in this case. The FCC has said they are not going to bring it to the Supreme Court. They are going to take a step back, and they are going to wait and see how internet service providers here in the United States handle this decision, whether they start running amok and turning to Netflix and saying, hey, you want your content getting there sooner rather than later? Pay us a little extra.
Well, forget getting there sooner. Netflix takes up so much of the pipeline. Their stock fell 5% in trading because people imagine suddenly Netflix will have to pay a lot extra just to maintain the service that they have right now.
Here's what I think. I don't think that Comcast and Time Warner Cable and all of the service providers will immediately start increasing the amount they are charging to Netflix. They're already charging us as consumers for consuming the content through their pipes, through their lines.
So they get to charge twice, all the
better.
And
that's what they're, of course, looking to do, because when you're looking to grow and expand and increase revenue, where are you going to turn? You need new customers and new revenue models. You, of course, want to turn to the other people shoving content through your pipes. What this ruling allows internet service providers to do is to turn to the Netflixes of the world, the Amazons of the world, and charge more money. Netflix would have had a rough time getting into streaming if they were being charged for delivery of their content rather than just the bandwidth out of their servers.
Right. So no new YouTube, no new Vimeo, no new Netflix, no new anybody who wants to innovate and start a new company, because it'd be that much harder and more expensive to get a leg up.
Here's what I think is really going to happen, because the internet service providers know The FCC is just waiting for them to make a move on this, and they're going to leap all over it. In other words, they're saying, we're not going to arrest you before you commit the crime. We're going to kind of let you commit the crime.
It's not a crime.
Well, yeah, right. I understand that. I'm just kind of, we're going to wait and see how you behave, and then we're going to decide how we're going to respond. And because of that, I think the internet service providers will be, the ISPs, they're going
to be... Well, so what? Look 10 years down the road when there's a new administration in office and a new head of the FCC who doesn't care, which was the case for 8 years, just a minute ago, they won't care. They'll encourage them to do it. Go ahead, make more money. We love untrammeled democracy. And then you'll have them charging it. I mean, so what if tomorrow they don't start doing it? They start doing it 5 years from now. It's still a disastrous thing. I agree with the person from the Consumers Union. They said it leaves consumers at the mercy of a handful of cable and phone providers that can give preferential treatment to the content they profit from. Imagine during the next election cycle, if you get to pay to have your website launch quicker than your opponent. You're an incumbent. You have more money. Suddenly, your website is easier to access than their website. You want to go to Joe Blow's website, and it takes 5 minutes to load up. Well, guess what? Your website loads up in 30 seconds. You seem more smart, more professional, more quick. Your video doesn't freeze. Who do you think you're going to be more impressed by?
Right. I agree. I don't think, because the ISPs will want to avoid regulation in this area, and they're going to want to avoid it at all costs.
You're saying because they're worried about regulation that would restrict them, they're going to do the things that the regulation would do anyway. That's a fantasy.
No. I think what will wind up happening is they will go in through the back door, and they're going to turn to you, Michael, and they're going to say, you have a 250 gigabyte per month limit, okay? So whether it's incoming or
they're already doing that.
Right. And so what they will do is they'll turn to Netflix and they'll say, hey, if you cut a deal with us, okay, all of the content that we deliver to Michael, it's not going to count against his cap.
Right, but that's added to the cost of doing business. It doesn't matter what way
they
do
it. That's not prioritizing traffic, okay? That's still...
Yes, it is, because the new company that wants to be the Netflix or a competitor to Netflix can't afford to make that deal.
That is,
I'm going to hit my cap in 5 minutes with this new company, and suddenly I'll find their service is really slow and really crappy. And I'm going to be unhappy with it.
No, that's the thing. Netflix and the new company's traffic will be delivered to you at the same speed, the same quality.
They can also make a deal and say, we'll just make yours be quicker. It won't count against his cap.
Well, then that would be shaping traffic. And they're going to keep the traffic at the same speed, same prioritization.
Why would you say that? Since they've said repeatedly they want to throttle people back and stop traffic that's chewing up the pipeline.
Because
they've said 100 times in a row that they don't want to. And you're saying, well, yes, but because Obama administration, the FCC guys in charge, they won't do it. Well, so what? In 2 years from now, they will. They're going to make every penny they can by charging everybody they possibly can money. We have the worst internet service in the world, in the free world. We have the slowest, the worst, and the most expensive. And that's only going to get worse thanks to this ruling, period.
Well, I would agree 100% with everything you're saying. I do think that for a short time here, the ISPs will not shape traffic and will not...
Big deal. Who cares?
Will not...
Robert M. McDowell, that last head of the FCC, who voted against adopting the internet rules, blah, said the internet was working beautifully before these rules were implemented. It will thrive even more now that they've been struck down. In the meantime, ample laws already exist to protect consumers should market failures occur. Give me a break.
Well, and I think in the meantime, in the next 5, 6, 7 years, however long this Comcast thing stands, I think that what will wind up happening is all these ISPs will create fictitious markets. And by that, I mean, they will start creating these barriers for you, Michael, to get content such as these caps, and then remove the barriers for the content. Oh, you're a content provider and you can't get to Michael because he's already over his cap. Well, strike a deal with me. We'll still prioritize all the traffic the same. All the traffic will be prioritized exactly the same. No need for regulation there, because I've created a fictitious market by turning to Netflix and saying, your traffic won't count.
They're going to use every trick in the book.
Right, exactly. That's what I'm saying. Now, yeah. I think the huge danger here is what you've already pointed out, is that Comcast owns NBC Universal. You know, NBC Universal has content. And if you're going to charge Netflix for content, and you're not going to charge NBC Universal for that.
Of course not.
Yeah, it creates huge competitive disadvantages. It's not an even playing field. It is exactly what the Paramount Decree back in 1948 was meant to prevent, with movie theater owners and studios, studios owning movie theaters. It's the exact same thing. Yeah. the Paramount decree and doctrine was put in place so that you couldn't be vertically integrated, and these cable companies and ISPs and content companies, they're all the same company.
I don't care
now.
If they're vertical or not. Even if they're separate, I don't want them being able to decide, give priority to traffic that they get extra money for. Just think of you're in a small town. You've got five businesses out there. They're all trying to get your business to fix your car, and they all got telephone numbers. And if you call one of them, it takes a minute for the phone number to connect. You call the other one, it's picked up and answered right away. Guess which one you're going to use? You're going to use the one whose phone is answered right away. You don't have the weird long delays. And so it's not a fair level playing ground. If different phone numbers work better than other phone numbers, people are going to naturally go to the one where the phone number works better. That's going to happen online, and it's a disaster.
Well, you know, hopefully you'll be able to receive our podcast very quickly. and you know, the traffic won't be shaped, and there won't be any delay in you receiving it. And even subscribing to it. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. We don't charge you a dime, so feel free to subscribe to the show, rate and review the show in any podcast aggregator, especially iTunes and the Microsoft Marketplace. It really does help us out. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com, which is where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us or to follow us on Twitter. At Showbiz Sandbox is our username. Or we have a page on Facebook that you can like. Showbiz Sandbox is the page. And again, all of that information can be found on showbizsandbox.com, like our email address, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Again, showbizsandbox.com is where you can find all of that information. You know where you can find the good folks who provide our music at the head and end of each show? That's the indie rock group MGMT, and they can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is MGMT.com. Michael Giltz can be found in various places besides New York, but online he can be found in numerous places. Michael, why don't you tell us where you can be found this week?
Net Neutrality Now. NetNeutralityNow.com.
Okay, well, you know, if you have trouble finding any of Michael's writing on the entertainment industry there, you can also try michaelgiltz.com, or you can go to his website, bookfilter.com. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.